Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, commentary, and information about the African American community. This week, I have readings from the United Nations News Service, Practical Boat Owner Magazine, and the following newspapers: the New York Amsterdam News, the New York Times, the Chicago Defender, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, USA Today, and I'm starting with three stories about non-black supporters of the Afro-American community. The first is from the website wordinblack.com. The title is, Why a Japanese-American Lawyer Wants Reparations for Black Californians. It was written by Renata Sago and published September 13, 2024. When Donald Tamaki got a call from the governor's office asking him to interview for a position on California's Reparations Task Force, at first he hesitated. Tamaki is not black. He has never identified as black. And to his knowledge, he is not a descendant of formerly enslaved African Americans. He is an acclaimed San Francisco-based lawyer whose parents are among 120,000 Japanese Americans forced into internment camps during World War II. He won a landmark Supreme Court case that forced the federal government to pay reparations for internment camp survivors. Growing up in Oakland in the late 1960s, Tamaki witnessed the burgeoning Black Consciousness Movement, in which black activists fought for fair housing laws in California and against workplace discrimination against black people. The parallels between that movement's goals and the Japanese-American struggle for equality in California, especially World War II-era bigotry that branded them as un-American, helped convince Tamaki to join the groundbreaking first-of-its-kind task force. There's no equivalence between 400 years of oppression and 4 years in a concentration camp that Japanese Americans went through. But the histories do intersect, Tamaki says. I realized after joining the task force that whatever prejudice was directed at Asian Americans and Japanese Americans in particular was really just a subchapter in a racial pathology that really began long before Asian Americans arrived on these shores. California is the first of the 50 U.S. states and territories to launch a reparations task force for black descendants of enslaved people. Black Californians comprise a little over 5% of the state's population, with many residents having migrated from the South through the 1970s. The California Reparations Task Force has been charged with studying the feasibility of compensation for descendants of formerly enslaved African Americans. Its 9-member body of elected officials, professors, and a theologian, all black with the exception of Tamaki. Japanese Americans made up less than 1% of the U.S. population from the 1940s to the 1960s, with the majority of them living in California. They're uprooting from their own homes and communities to makeshift government camps in remote areas of Utah, Wyoming, and Oregon, began right after the attacks on Pearl Harbor. Even though most of the families were either naturalized or native-born American citizens, the U.S. government didn't want to take chances that they might sympathize with the Japanese imperial government. So the Roosevelt administration forcibly relocated entire communities, sending them to live in hastily converted fairgrounds, racetracks, and livestock stalls. My family owned a 4-flat hotel for immigrants right in the center of San Francisco's Japantown, Tamaki says. By the 1960s, Japantown was reduced from 44 blocks to 4. The community was just evicted. I don't have the lived experience to be black, but we do know something about racial profiling, he says. We do know something about being targeted. In the 1980s, Tamaki helped reopen Korematsu versus United States, a case that led to a formal apology from the federal government for harm against the Japanese-American political detainees and $20,000 in restitution for living survivors. While Tamaki believes that it's difficult to determine how vindication looks, careful attention to civil rights issues is critical. So far, that California Reparations Task Force has held 27 contentious hearings throughout California starting in 2021. The discussions were based on the International Reparations Framework, which lays out five forms of reparations: restitution, compensation, rehabilitation, satisfaction, and guarantees of non-repetition. In June 2023, the task force released a 1,100-page final report detailing the history of discriminatory practices that harmed generations of Black Californians. The report provides national and regional analysis and includes a range of recommendations, including things like minimum wage hikes and proposals to help communities deal with climate change. But it doesn't explicitly describe what a successful reparations program might look like. The report, in and of itself, was a compromise, Tamaki says. Sometimes the discussion was hard and was probably very hurtful, Tamaki says. What we did say is, legislature, here's 115 recommendations. Legislate and come up with an approach spanning years, in good economies and bad. For Tamaki, however, educating the public about what reparations are and aren't is critical. The most common objections to reparations, which I'm sure you've heard them, the litany of, it's too late, this is all about slavery, or it's too much, the government can't afford this, he says. Another one is, it's not my fault, I was not an enslaver and discriminating against anybody, why should I as a taxpayer have to pay for this? But, he says, it's a matter of justice for people who have suffered historical wrongs. What I realized is that the last 2 years won't mean anything unless the next 2 years and the years to follow mean something. That was the article, Why a Japanese-American Lawyer Wants Reparations for Black Californians. It was written by Renata Sago and published September 13, 2024 at the website wordinblack.com. My next reading is from the New York Amsterdam News newspaper. The title is, Black Indigenous Communities Can Work Together to Strengthen Reparative Justice, report says. It was written by Karen Carrillo and published December 12, 2024. A new report from the Bliss Collective says that when Black and Indigenous groups combine their interest, it strengthens the push for reparative justice. The Black Liberation Indigenous Sovereignty, BLISS, Collective, a new organization created in 2022, will issue its first report in January 2025. The study titled Fabric of Repair, The Impact of Braiding Narratives of Reparations and Land Back on Black and Indigenous Audiences, reveals that while Black and Indigenous communities often prioritize their own issues, they are also likely to support each other's reparative efforts when provided with sufficient information. Bliss wants to get that sort of information out by promoting narratives that illustrate the connection between settler colonialism and the exploitation enslavers used against Black people. The organization sees itself as a solidarity and action hub that braids narratives and grows movements, said co-founder and executive Trevor Smith. How Bliss was born was, my co-founder, Savannah Romero, we met in grad school, and I were at a party one day, just kind of talking about our work, Smith told the Amsterdam News. The conversation kind of got to the place of asking ourselves, why isn't the Black land movement for reparations and the Indigenous land movement for land back more connected? They didn't feel as connected as we thought they should be, despite obviously not the exact same histories, but similar goals that relate to repairing the hurts caused by colonization and the transatlantic slave trade. The Black reparations movement and the Indigenous land back movement have each had to overcome crippling societal efforts to destroy them. Mainstream U.S. culture is based on a history that justified genocide, land theft, and the violent pursuit of wealth. The basic tenets that support anti-indigeneity and anti-blackness, the Bliss Report contends. After trying to exterminate Native Americans, the United States simply sent them to live apart from the rest of society. The resulting invisibility of indigenous experiences in mainstream discourse has led to widespread public apathy toward indigenous rights and justice, the report states. A 2018 survey found that 72% of Americans rarely encounter or receive information about Native Americans. People cannot mobilize or advocate against a problem that they aren't aware of, which is what makes the erasure of indigenous people such an effective narrative tool for those looking to hoard power, suppress challengers to a white supremacist status quo, and manipulate ideals such as democracy and freedom to legitimize inequality and maintain dominance within social and political systems. Anti-blackness, the report also says, is regularly evidenced by police violence, the perpetuation of the black-white wealth gap, and the depressed social, economic, and political power of all black people that has grown on the backs of black women. Indigenous and black activists share an interconnected history, yet they don't often associate their struggles. The Bliss Report calls on activists to show visible and vocal solidarity with each other. Doing so can change the dynamics of how reparative justice efforts are responded to by the larger society. As part of the report, Bliss surveyed 2,886 people, looking for their responses to videos that spoke about either the reparations movement, the land back movement, or both movements at once. Smith said that Bliss couldn't predict which kind of videos would be most popular. We really wanted to get a baseline understanding of how much support exists between black and indigenous communities on the topic of reparations and land back, and what the effects would be when we produced the video that talked about both of these movements and the interconnectedness of these movements. We found that the video that braided the narratives together was effective at increasing support for reparations and land back within black and indigenous audiences. One video the organization recently made has social media content creator Garrison Hayes talk about the United States' two original sins. This land belonged to indigenous people, Hayes says about the plantation just outside of Nashville, Tennessee, that was once owned by Andrew Jackson. In fact, this region was home to some 600,000 indigenous people, including Cherokee, Chickasaw, and Shawnee people. But between the years 1492 and 1900, European settlers stole more than 1.5 billion acres of land from indigenous people across what is now the United States. At the same time, those settlers were building America's wealth on the backs of enslaved Africans. By 1860, the value of enslaved people was estimated to be between $3.1 and $3.6 billion, an amount more valuable than all the railroads and factories in this country at the time, combined. Efforts to combine black and indigenous narratives will be long-term and generational, the kind of work that will be necessary to build solidarity. The growing national effort to fight for black reparative justice policies is mostly taking place on the local level. Places like Evanston, Illinois, Los Angeles, California, Boston, Massachusetts, Kansas City, Missouri, and New York State are studying the idea of reparation programs for black Americans. As they build locally, these programs can note how land back and reparations ideas work together. There's one graphic that goes along with this story. It shows a person holding up a sign that says, "Indigenous People for Black Lives." And above that are the official seals of 8 indigenous nations. They are the Great Seal of the Shinnecock Indian Nation, the Unkachok Nation, the Seneca Nation of Indians, Keeper of the Western Door, the St. Regis Mohawk Tribe, the Cayuga Nation, the Tuscarora Nation of Indians, the Onondaga Nation, People of the Hills, and the Oneida Nation. That was the article titled, "Black Indigenous Communities Can Work Together to Strengthen Reparative Justice," report states. It was written by Karen Carrillo and published December 12, 2024 in the New York Amsterdam News newspaper. My next reading on today's African American Hour is about an individual whose Puerto Rican civil rights organization allied with the Black Panther Party in Chicago. The title is Jose Chacha Jimenez, Civil Rights Leader and Young Lords Founder, Dies at 76. It was written by the Chicago Defender staff and published January 15, 2025, at the ChicagoDefender.com website. Jose Cha-Cha Jimenez, a fierce advocate for justice and the founder of Chicago's Young Lords, has died at age 76. His sister Daisy Rodriguez announced his death on Friday morning. The cause of death was not disclosed. Jimenez began the Young Lords in the 1960s as a street gang to defend Puerto Ricans in Lincoln Park, then one of Chicago's poorest neighborhoods. By 1968, the group became a force for social change, inspired by the Black Panther Party. Cha-Cha became one of the most pivotal figures in civil rights and liberation movements, his family said in a statement. He leaves behind a profound legacy of revolutionary spirit, a vision for Puerto Rican self-determination, and a commitment to justice for the people. The Young Lords took on racism, police abuse, and poverty. They pushed for better health care, housing, and schools. They also created free programs offering meals, medical care, and spaces for people to organize and fight for their rights. In 1969, Jimenez helped form the Rainbow Coalition, working with Fred Hampton of the Black Panther Party and William Preacher Man Vesperman of the Young Patriots. Together, they united Black, Latino, and poor white communities to tackle poverty and discrimination. Rest in power to my dear friend Jose Cha-Cha Jimenez. Your mark on this day will never be forgotten. Thank you for your contribution to the liberation of all people. All power to the people, wrote former U.S. Congressman Bobby L. Rush. Filmmaker Ray Santisteban credited Jimenez for his dedication. From the first time I met him in 1992 until the last time I saw him, he was solely focused on working to uplift and empower the Puerto Rican community and all poor people in the world. Born on August 8, 1940, in Caguas, Puerto Rico, Jimenez grew up in Chicago's La Clark neighborhood. He became the first Latino to run for alderman in 1974, opposing gentrification of Lincoln Park. His campaign helped assert Puerto Rican political power in the city. Even after the Young Lords ceased their activism in the late 1970s, Jimenez preserved their history. In 1995, he worked with DePaul University to create an archive of their work. In 2023, DePaul honored him with his Public Intellectual Award. And in 2024, a historical marker was placed on its campus to commemorate the Young Lords. Jimenez is survived by 5 children and 3 sisters. That was the obituary. Jose Cha-Cha Jimenez, civil rights leader and Young Lords founder, dies at 76. It was written by the Chicago Defender staff and published January 15, 2025 at the ChicagoDefender.com website. My next reading is an obituary from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The title is Charles Person, Pioneer Freedom Writer, Dies at 82. It was written by Phil Clore and published January 12, 2025. It didn't get bad until the Trailways bus crossed the state line from Georgia into Albany in May of 1961. A gang of white men boarded the bus in Anniston, Alabama, and started beating the handful of young black and white freedom riders who were on board, forcing them into the back. The riders did not fight back as they had been taught. Even when they were beating me, I didn't yell out. I didn't cry. I didn't cover up, Charles Person told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution in 2021. When the bus reached the terminal in Birmingham, Person recalled 40 years later, "The entire wall was lined with white men, and they just came toward us, and they started beating us with pipes and sticks in their fists." Far from stopping the Freedom Riders on their first trip to call attention to Jim Crow laws in the Deep South, the brutal racist reaction got nationwide media attention and convinced more than 400 people to join Charles Person, John Lewis, and others in this crucial early chapter of the civil rights movement. The courage Charles Person displayed when he boarded those buses as the youngest of the original Freedom Riders, knowing that he was potentially risking his life in the fight against segregation, should be an inspiration for every person, young or old, who believes in a more just and equitable future for all, said Margaret Wang, president and CEO of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Charles confronted the ugliest elements of the South at that time and refused to let them shake his will. Among the first group of 13 freedom riders, carefully vetted and trained in nonviolence, Person was the youngest at 18. A freshman at Morehouse College, he fibbed to his parents that he did not think the trip would be very dangerous, so they gave their permission for him to go. Charles had an inner spirit in him that just spoke joy, shouted joy, sang joy, said Richard Rooker, co-author of Person's 2021 autobiography, Buses Are Coming, Memoir of a Freedom Rider. He was a lifelong champion for justice and equality and dignity, Rooker added. He also believed that tomorrow would be better than today, even when circumstances suggest otherwise. Charles Person died January 8, 2025, of complications from leukemia at his home in Fayetteville. He was 82. Of the original 13 Freedom Riders, only one, Henry Thomas of Stone Mountain, remains alive. Person was born September 27, 1942, in Atlanta to Hugh and Ruby Person, a medical orderly and a domestic worker. He grew up with seven family members in two rooms with no electricity or indoor plumbing in Buttermilk Bottom, an impoverished black neighborhood that was demolished in the 1960s to build the Atlanta Civic Center. Person recalled seeing his mother have to eat out of a, quote, special dish, unquote, with the white family she worked for cause she couldn't eat out of their dishes, Rooker said. He graduated as salutatorian from David T. Howard High School in 1960. As a freshman at Morehouse College in 1960, Person and fellow students staged sit-ins at segregated Atlanta lunch counters. He was arrested several times and spent 16 days in jail. At the sit-ins, white people would throw ketchup and mustard and sometimes flick lit cigarettes on the protesters. Person recalled for a 2001 University of Mississippi oral history project on the Freedom Riders. You've got to realize that for a lot of these whites, this was the first time that blacks had rebelled, he said. Normally, you knew your place and knew what was expected of you, and everybody was happy. But we weren't happy. After his freedom ride, Person joined the U.S. Marine Corps and served 20 years, including postings in Vietnam, Okinawa, Cuba, and Hawaii. He mainly worked as an electrical technician. When he left the Marines, he continued that occupation, starting his own business and working for Atlanta Public Schools. He was married to Carolyn Henderson, and they had three daughters, Cicely, Cammie, and Carmel. After they divorced, he married Joetta Mapp in 1986, and they had two children, Brandon and Keisha. Person toured regularly, giving speeches on his days in the movement along with other freedom riders, including Joan Browning. We really tried to communicate to young people that you don't have to get on a bus and go to jail, said Browning. There's all kinds of things you can do. The fact that he was a military veteran helped, she added. People think that nonviolent people are sissies. He was no sissy. He was a combat veteran. He would wear his combat medals. Another part of Person's legacy is the Freedom Riders Training Academy in Anniston. What they did was so profoundly important, we didn't want it just to be locked up in history, said Pete Conroy, co-chairman with Person of the Academy. The Academy is scheduled to officially launch in the coming weeks, Conroy said. He can't be around to see it, but he knew it was coming. That was the obituary titled, Charles Person, pioneer freedom rider, dies at 82. He helped to desegregate public transportation. It was written by Phil Clore and published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on Sunday, January 12, 2025. My next reading is titled, A Reigniting of My Fire and My Angst. Africa Trip Inspires Black History's Protection. It was written by Deborah Berry and published December 30, 2024 in the USA Today newspaper. The Reverend Siobhan Arlene Bradley left Angola earlier this month more inspired than ever to preserve African American history. The visit, she said, standing near this African city's National Slavery Museum, makes me committed to putting my feet 10 toes down into black history. Arlene Bradley, capital ARLINE dash capital BRADLEY, president of the National Council of Negro Women, joined a VIP delegation with President Joe Biden on a trip to Angola where, centuries ago, Africans from the region were enslaved and brought to what would become the United States. Coming here was bigger than just being part of a delegation, she said. It was a reigniting of my fire and my angst of being a black mother in America, with my black son asking questions about himself, not understanding the history except when I teach it. Other national historians and civil rights leaders who joined the trip, which included visits to the Slavery Museum and the Museum of Anthropology, said it also fueled their passion for protecting African American history. It comes at a time when some Americans have seemingly become more uncomfortable with teaching aspects of the nation's history, including centuries of slavery. There's this fear of understanding the complexity of America. This fear of saying that America has made mistakes. America has benefited from things that are horrific, said Lonnie Bunch, secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, who was also in Angola. But Bunch said true appreciation will only come from knowledge. In essence, what you also get is an understanding that these are examples of where America is a work in progress. In recent years, lawmakers in some states have pushed to restrict the teachings of black history in banned books, many about race and by authors of color. Civil rights activists, faith leaders, and others have launched programs to counter those efforts. They're going to be pushing back for a long time. But I think the key is, how do you push back against the pushback, said Bunch, also founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. You have evidence. You have research. You have candor. You have people who are willing to say, this is important and here's why. The next section of the article is titled, History of Slavery Overlooked on Both Continents. As the crowd waited for Biden to deliver remarks on a stage near the National Slavery Museum, Tanya Matthews, president of the International African American Museum, sat in the front row facing the ocean. The museum she leads overlooks a wharf in Charleston, South Carolina, on the other side of the Atlantic. I feel like I'm looking across the water at the institution, Matthews said. I'm looking across the centuries at a more appropriate telling of history and the story. There's some shared grief on both sides. There's also shared wrangling about how we should tell the story, and I think that's a little encouraging to know that our sister country struggles as much as we do. Last year, Angolan President João Lourenço visited the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. This history, that is part of our common history, Lourenço told them. Derek Johnson, president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, who was also part of the VIP delegation, praised Biden for closing out his presidency with the Angola trip. Johnson called the history between Angola and the United States rich and deep, adding that the rice industry in America grew into a billion-dollar industry because enslaved Angolans brought the know-how for growing rice to places like South Carolina and Georgia. That's a history we should never allow to be repeated, and the way you do that is by understanding and studying it, Johnson said. The final section of the story is titled, The United States Has Been Complicit. Arlene Bradley's National Council of Negro Women plans to work with the African American Policy Forum to create a black history curriculum to be shared with community groups. It also intends to launch a campaign to teach civics education in black communities. I feel the connection here, Arlene Bradley said of the trip to Angola, adding that the experience comes with the responsibility. This is not just for the cameras. This opportunity is actually helping us recommit to telling the full story on where we have been complicit, she said. The United States of America has been complicit in hiding the story. Bunch agreed. History is not something you can run away from. History is something that shapes us, he said. You can run, but you cannot hide. That was the USA Today newspaper article titled, A Reigniting of My Fire and My Angst. Africa Trip Inspires Black History's Protection. It was written by Deborah Berry and published December 30th, 2019. 2024. My next reading is from the United Nations News Service. The title is, The Second International Decade for People of African Descent Renews the Call for Recognition, Justice, and Development. This was published December 19, 2024, and was written by the United Nations staff. The Second International Decade for People of African Descent was proclaimed on December 17, 2024. This second international decade is an opportunity to take concrete actions to confront the legacies of enslavement and colonialism, deliver reparatory justice, and secure the full human rights and freedoms of people of African descent worldwide. The first international decade, while a significant milestone, fell short in delivering transformative change according to several experts on the human rights of people of African descent. Barbara Reynolds, chair of the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent, WGEPAD, said that the initial effort increased awareness of anti-black racism and the human rights of people of African descent, but lacked enough political will and investment for member states. It's now time to turn the rhetoric into reality, the acknowledgement into answers, and the apologies into action to address the unfinished business of racial justice. For reparatory justice to right historical wrongs, for environmental justice, for sustainable development, and for digital justice to assure the future of all peoples, Reynolds said. Reynolds highlighted key outcomes of the first international decade, including increased visibility of Afro-descendant issues, the establishment of the Permanent Forum on People of African Descent, PFPAD, and the ongoing work on the United Nations Declaration on the Respect, Protection and Fulfillment of the Human Rights of People of African Descent. However, much remains to be achieved. The chair of the Permanent Forum on People of African Descent, June Sumer, agreed and emphasized that while some gains were achieved, structural inequalities in education, health care, housing, economic opportunities, and political representation persist. She said that systemic racism continues to deprive people of African descent of basic human rights, exacerbated by climate vulnerabilities, digital exclusion, and environmental injustices. The fight against racism and racial discrimination is far from over. It is a fight that must not wane but intensify because the vision of a world free from these pervasive scourges remains an urgent and moral imperative for all of us, Sumer said. The first international decade raised global awareness and strengthened legal and institutional frameworks. The United Nations efforts during the period included supporting the development of anti-discrimination laws, national action plans, and institutional measures, promoting cultural heritage through initiatives like UNESCO's Routes of Enslaved Peoples and General History of Africa, supporting anti-racism education and awareness campaigns globally, as well as equipping people of African descent with tools to claim their rights, for example, through the Fellowship Program for People of African Descent. Despite these advances, Sumer noted persistent challenges in the lack of implementation of the Durban Declaration and Program of Action, a comprehensive international framework for combating racism and racial discrimination. The continued challenge of addressing economic empowerment of people of African descent, compounded by limited and even reversal of access to economic opportunities, remains a persistent struggle, said Sumer. Health disparities, especially those affecting women and girls of African descent, require urgent and sustained attention. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights was the coordinator of the first international decade's activities. UN Human Rights encouraged states and other stakeholders to take action, raised awareness on issues affecting people of African descent, and fostered greater recognition, respect, and celebration of their diverse heritage and culture. We have supported the launch and the implementation of the program of activities of the international decade in several countries and regions, said Sarah Hamoud, chief of the Anti-Racial Discrimination Section. 160 activists of African descent, 70% of whom are women, from 50 different countries have graduated from our annual fellowship program, and we have supported 14 civil society projects through grants and partnerships. UN Human Rights has also played a vital role in shedding light on the human rights challenges faced by people of African descent through dedicated research and campaigns. UN Human Rights supported the establishment of the Permanent Forum on People of African Descent in 2021, and since 2022, it supports the intergovernmental discussions on the elaboration of draft United Nations Declaration on the Respect, Protection, and Fulfillment of the Human Rights of People of African Descent. The proclamation of the Second International Decade builds on progress made so far, but more than anything, it is an acknowledgement that much more needs to be done, Hamoud said. Over the past decade, we have gained greater understanding and visibility of the lived experiences of people of African descent, but not enough has been done to create real positive changes in their lives. UN Human Rights future strategies are multi-pronged. Some of these include supporting states and others to dismantle systemic racism and deliver reparatory justice, strengthening civil society networks and capacity-building programs, advocating for meaningful participation of people of African descent in decision-making processes, and for data collection disaggregated by race and ethnicity to inform policies, promoting equal and sustainable economies, and combating environmental and digital injustice. That was the article, The Second International Decade for People of African Descent Renews the Call for Recognition, Justice, and Development. It was written by the United Nations staff and published December 19, 2024 by the United Nations News Service at the website ohchr.org. My next reading looks at the lives of two sailors who have passed away. The title is The Pioneers, The Lives of the First African-American Sailors to Sail Solo Around the World. It was written by H.E. Ross and published in the February 2025 edition of the British magazine called Practical Boat Owner. Captain Bill Pinckney and Captain Teddy Seymour both passed away last year, leaving a legacy that should be welcome applause to a point in history that sees too much conflict and division. Their legacy could be said to be without a chance. They became the first African Americans to have sailed around the world single-handed. Why emphasize African American in place of just sailor? Good question that I hope to answer in this article. Captain Bill Pinckney, born on 15 September 1935 and died on 31 August 2023. The first black man to circumnavigate the world solo via the five southernmost capes, accomplished from 5 August 1990 to 9 June 1992. I started sailing in Puerto Rico and I loved it from the start, Captain Bill Pinckney nods and continues. I think it's the independence of it. In sailing, you have absolute sovereignty. You have an opportunity to at least temporarily capture nature and bend it to your will. I say temporarily because nature changes. The sea's calm and then it's stormy. When you think you've mastered it, it masters you. If you met the very affable Bill Pinckney on the street or while trying to talk you into supporting one of his projects, you'd not think of him as a humble man. At 80, he shared a Facebook post showing off his cha-cha moves. No, the one-time limbo exhibitionist and Revlon executive would not be the one facing the wall at a party. But Pinckney was also dedicated to paving the way for children to be confident and not shy to get aboard sailing boats the way he was when he was young. Of course, building a dinghy and having to be rescued might have influenced the safety part of his push to get children into a real grasp of freedom offered by sailing and away from the grasp of the street. For his circumnavigation, Pinckney chose a cutter-rigged Valiant 47, named appropriately Lone Star. Why did he choose this particular design and sail plan? The cutter rig of the Valiant provided a variety of sail options without too much handling on the deck. With contributions from many, including the investment firm Aldrich Eastman and Walsh, he was able to purchase the Valiant 47. This particular boat had solid offshore credentials. The boat had previously been sailed successfully and without much hardship by Captain Mark Schrader in the 1986-1987 BOC Challenge. With the vision of owning this boat, the direction of his project changed. I was going to sail around with a 32-foot boat, go through the Panama and Suez canals and write to my grandchildren to tell them not only about where I was and what I was doing, but how I was using all the things that I learned in the first 12 years of education. But using his mantra, "Never let a chance go by," he changed the concept, bought Lone Star, renamed her commitment, changed rigging and equipment where needed, and sailed 27,000 miles in a little less than a year and a half alone. He was 55 with very little experience of sailing long distances alone, having mostly raced as crew or solo aboard his 28-foot Pearson Triton in Lake Michigan. His scheduled stops were at Salvador, Brazil, Cape Town in South Africa, where he memorably sailed past Nelson Mandela's island prison of Robben Island, flying a spinnaker of red, black, and green, the colors African Americans displayed in their struggle for freedom from second-class citizenship and discrimination, Hobart, Tasmania, and Punta del Este in Uruguay. With further acumen, Pinckney moved the original concept to a greater one by giving sponsorship talks with the idea of then transmitting a daily passage report to 30,000 children. At each stop, he'd send videotape messages home to his wife, Ina, and the school children of Chicago and Boston. 700 children were on the dock at the Charlestown Navy Yard to greet him as he tied up commitment behind the USS Constitution on his return. The streets do offer a need for self-reliance in observance of ever-changing situations. I found that the youth who were court referrals grasped the concept of change faster than those I taught who did not have that need in everyday life. Bill Pinckney was a man who came from the streets, with the single parent and poverty background that many see as destined to end only one way. But he went another way that showed alternatives that he was open to throughout his life. Never let a chance go by helped him sail around the five southernmost capes to tie up where he'd cast off. Then he went on to get sponsorships for his Middle Passage Project voyages to Africa, South America, and the United States to form an African studies curriculum for teachers who made the voyages. His crowning achievement was to be the first skipper aboard the error-replicated Amistad and to meld that representation of a successful slave mutiny into a Middle Passage Project voyage under the auspices of the Mystic Seaport Museum. The original ship, La Amistad, was seized by the authorities after Mende captives took control of the ship in Cuba and tried to sail it back to Africa. The subsequent court case became the first human rights case in the U.S. Supreme Court, which was won by the Mende. Captain Pinckney emphasized the freedom aspect of the sailing world. That's the identity that all of us who sail want. Religion, sexuality, color, none of that has anything to do with the fact that, first and foremost, we're sailors. Unfortunately, written maritime history usually emphasizes European maritime history. We, up to this moment, still have to say black maritime history to include what is being scantily researched about our involvement on the water. Going back through time, black mariner Captain Alexander Leetsdorf sailed his schooner with the crew from New York to the village of Yerba Buena, and after setting up trade routes between Mexico, Hawaii, Alaska, and this little village, he had the name officially changed back to the Spanish mission name of San Francisco de Assisi. Captain Leetsdorf is buried at Mission Dolores. Assisting the first successful slave revolt in Haiti was the first black officer in the British Royal Navy, Captain John Jackpunch Perkins, who captured over 300 ships during his service. The first Back to Africa movement was accomplished by the Horatio Alger type, Captain Paul Cuffey, who took them to Sierra Leone aboard one of his 11 ships. Cuffey traded and whaled along the coast of Africa, the Mediterranean, the Baltic, and even the slave-owning states in the newly founded United States of America. The first 6 books written about the enslavement experience in America were written by black mariners who understood and appreciated the concept of freedom. The next part of the article is about Captain Teddy Seymour and is titled, "The Detailist." Captain Teddy Seymour, born on October 1st, 1941, and died on April 11, 2023. The first black man to circumnavigate the world solo, selling from 24 February 1986 to 19 June 1987. Though Teddy Seymour had a similar upbringing to Bill Pinkney, with his mother making sacrifices to ensure that her four children had just enough, Teddy had a more racially traumatic upbringing during his ghetto school years. Luckily, he saw that one spark that changed his world when his principal assigned him to athletics and his coach mentored him in such a way that he became a cross-country track star. This earned young Teddy a scholarship, and with that acceptance and celebration by his college peers, that in turn made him a happy student. In 1965, Ted joined the Marines and became an officer as he held a diploma. Eventually retiring from the Marines 7 years later, he'd completed a tour in Vietnam and was the 31st black captain in the history of the Marine Corps, the oldest branch of services in the United States. He started sailing with the Marines around Camp Pendleton in Southern California. After learning in a couple of dinghies, he'd bought a Columbia 26 and lived aboard for his last 2 years in the Corps. He then bought his love song, a Bruce King Carl Allberg-designed Ericsson 35 MK1. He took off and sailed down to Panama and across the Caribbean basin to the U.S. Virgin Islands, where he taught in a primary school. He then decided to sail around the world. According to his sister Ruth, Teddy described himself as someone who takes risks and overcomes challenges to accomplish a goal. He didn't start out with the dream of sailing solo, she said. He just wanted to sail. That is shown in his serious detailing and planning for a voyage that would happen 7 years later. During those 7 years, he accumulated most of the funds through saving and keeping his life simple. A major decision was made during the summer of 1985 to become departure date oriented. After the February 1986 departure date was set, the level of motivation reached zenith, and preparation activity heightened during several busy months. Captain Seymour's boat was generally sound, as proven by his voyage from San Diego to the U.S. Virgins. My Ericsson 35 is a solid full-keel boat. During 11 years of ownership, she has been heavily reinforced, modified, and equipped for solo cruising. The running rig was altered for the purpose of safety and convenience. Sails were hoisted by halyards tended from the cockpit. Lowering sails is also accomplished from the cockpit by pulling lines led to the head of the sails. The mainsail is held on the boom by lazy jacks, and the jib is held on the deck by a net connected to the forward stanchions. This method reduces the possibility of being thrown overboard in a rough sea and the displeasure of getting wet while working the foredeck. All new 5/16-inch stainless steel stays were installed, with the addition of double head stays. Having a mast stepped on deck requires a strong support system to transfer the force exerted through the mast to the keel. The tabernacle was dismantled and rebuilt with heavy timbers. The masthead was strengthened. Two previous collisions with logs off the coast of Central America, suffering no damage, has given me confidence in hull strength. Nevertheless, the bow has been fortified with 6 layers of 24-ounce mat and epoxy resin, he explained. The purchase of sails, ground tackle, satellite navigation, solar panels, refrigeration, and a ham radio helped deplete the money saved during the past 7 years of working 2 jobs 7 days per week. By departure date, the cruising budget diminished from $12,000 to $6,000. How can a world cruise be accomplished with a boatload of provisions and $6,000? Only 5 stops were planned, and money will only be spent on essentials. That's my no-frills circumnavigation of the world. In the end, Seymour made 12 stops on his voyage, which took him via the Panama and Suez canals to the likes of Bora Bora, Australia, Yemen, Israel, and Egypt before returning to Frederickstead, St. Croix, U.S. Virgin Islands. His 16-month circumnavigation was uneventful in terms of groundings and knockdowns, which he put down to his gear and planning. He was later honored by the likes of the Joshua Slocum Society and the Cruising Club of America, but otherwise received little mention in the press apart from in a few sailing magazines, and returned to his job teaching and living on Love Song. That was the article titled, The Pioneers, The Lives of the First African American Sailors to Sail Solo Around the World. It was written by H.E. Ross and published in the February 2025 edition of Practical Boat Owner Magazine. My next reading is from the New York Times Book Review. It's titled, Lust and Loss in the Upper Ranks of the Black Panther Party. Fabian Josaphat's novel, Kingdom of No Tomorrow, sets a love triangle amid late 1960s Oakland and Chicago. This review was written by Laura Worrell and published December 7, 2024. In her muscular, searing novel, Kingdom of No Tomorrow, the poet and fiction writer Fabian Josaphat fixes her lens on the late 1960s, a time of turmoil and transformation for black people the world over. Her protagonist, Nettie Boileau, emerges from the Haiti of Josaphat's debut, Dancing in the Baron's Shadow, where the brutal Duvalier dictatorship murdered as many as 60,000 people, into 1968 Oakland, California and Chicago, where the Black Panther Party is fighting for black liberation. Tracking the political and romantic awakening of 20-year-old Nettie, a black public health student who becomes increasingly entangled in a radical arm of the movement as she falls for one of its leaders, Josaphat erects a kind of love triangle as a scaffolding for the novel's central concerns. Amid revolution, how do you reconcile private needs with public struggle? With this tension in mind, the novel casts the family home as a site not just of solace and refuge, but of fracture wrought by external injustice. Nettie and her best friend, Clea, are collecting field data for a sickle cell study run by a Black Panther Party clinic in Oakland when they meet Melvin Mosley, a handsome but inscrutable party leader, in the home of a black family that's being harassed by their white neighbors. Clea is ready to take up arms to defend them, but Nettie is reluctant to engage in the kind of violence that got her father killed when he joined efforts to overthrow Duvalier's regime. When a rock crashes through the family's window, however, something inside her snapped, and she can't help hurling it back. Josaphat's assured prose often pauses to linger on exquisite moments of awe that drive Nettie's internal evolution. Under the lights of a party event, she thinks, everyone seemed more brilliant, more resplendent, like a gathering of gods by the hundreds. Later, Melvin's brown skin was almost lit from the inside, splendid like smoked quartz. In the opening scene, both Melvin's shotgun and his imperturbable cool shake her out of her fantasies of nonviolence. It was as if she'd been asleep her whole life and awakened tonight to the fact that the entire country was quickly tipping over, Josaphat writes. It was becoming clear that marching and sitting in were not enough. This episode kicks off a propulsive plot that asks tough questions about the sidelining of black women in the hypermasculine world of social justice. When a different male party leader behaves aggressively toward Clea, Nettie tries to embolden her. You don't have to put up with it, she says. You're not a thing God made to satisfy a man's hunger. But Nettie frustratingly fails to heed her own advice when it comes to her growing fascination with Melvin, who brings her along to weapons pickups and target practice, but who can be belittling, unreliable, and even cruel. Meanwhile, grieving her father while living in California with her aunt, Nettie battles her feelings of dislocation with the help of Clea's friendship, though Clea wants it to become something more. As these relationships in the movement progress, the three revolutionaries offer divergent paths to self-determination. As her boss's harassment worsens, Clea, a party faithful, daydreams about an alternative version of freedom on a friend's orange grove in Florida. Melvin remains dedicated to the cause. Until the pigs decide to put their guns down, he says, I have no reason to put mine down. Nettie wants to save lives the way her father did and follow her aunt's advice to finish her studies. The novel occasionally falters as the urgency of the historical moment sometimes eclipses the romance, and the very real political violence leaves less space to root for love. Still, when Melvin finally admits his feelings for Nettie, the pages practically turn themselves. As traitors, phone taps, and assassinations further complicate Nettie's feelings for Melvin and Clea, Nettie must ask herself whether having a common sense of purpose in a relationship truly makes you stronger, as a fellow activist suggests. With a poet's lyrical flair, Josephat delivers a novel for our times, exploring how individuals in an unjust society can manage both political upheaval and meaningful personal connection, both oppression and intimacy. That was a review of the book, Kingdom of No Tomorrow, written by Fabian Josephat. It's published by Algonquin. It's 274 pages long and retails for $28. The title of this New York Times book review is Lust and Loss in the Upper Ranks of the Black Panther Party. It was written by Laura Worrell and published December 7th, 2024. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.